Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
It's the Wonky Show, White Paper Special. There's a bold target of 2/3 of young people in higher level learning. We'll go across that. Fee rises, what's being asked in return, and everything else from access and participation to R&D. It's all coming up.
And Madam Deputy Speaker, this white paper delivers on that promise to our young people, to give them the skills they need. But the task of revitalising our skills system, it's mission-led government in action. And the prize, Madam Deputy Speaker, is huge. Opportunity for our young people, growth for our economy, and renewal for our nation. And I commend this statement to the House.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Beach, and here to dissect the white paper on publication night. It's Team Wonky. There's an awful lot to get through, and let's start with a big vision. Secretary of State Bridget Phillipson got up in Parliament this evening and set out a target for 2/3 of young people to participate in higher level learning by age 25. Let's have a listen.
That's why the target for 50% of our young people to go to university is evolving. Because to compete in this changing world, we need to nurture a much broader range of talent. So as the Prime Minister has announced, we have a new ambition. No longer just half. We want 2/3 of our young people to get into high-level learning, be it academic, be it technical, or be it an apprenticeship. But Madam Deputy Speaker, pro-technical, pro-vocational doesn't mean being anti-academic. Our universities are a stamp of quality recognised across the world, a source of immense national pride, a driver of economic strength in our regions. So to any young person growing up in England today, I say that if you want to go to university, if it's right for you, if you meet the requirements, this government will back you. That's why we're introducing new targeted maintenance grants for students most in need, funded by a levy on international students' fees. Because in this country, opening up access for domestic students from disadvantaged communities is my priority. Yeah. Madam Deputy Speaker, we need a system that delivers for working people living busy lives too. That's why we're making higher level learning more flexible, available in bite-sized chunks, breakpoints in degrees too, and supported by the lifelong learning entitlement. But Madam Deputy Speaker, it's not only degrees that matter. I want to see our universities working with colleges to deliver more level 4 and level 5 qualifications, to spread that excellence far and wide, making it easier for people to take on those vital courses in their local further education colleges.
Now, Debbie, a big white paper, a big ambition. Tell us what it's trying to do.
Well, this white paper has been a long time coming, and it is, I think, accordingly ambitious in what it sets out to achieve. It's fronted by three different government departments, three different ministers. That is Department for Work and Pensions, Department for Education, and the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology. And it's trying to get across the whole skills system from the learners who in some ways have not had a good time in their earlier education and are now sort of young people who are lacking or who are NEETs, you know, not in education, employment and training, trying to find ways to give them second chances to reskill, to upskill, to get into education and employment, all the way through to challenges around the postgraduate pipeline and loss of PhD specialisms in some areas. So it's, you know, it's really, really vast in its scope, and it's really, really, and it's trying to kind of tackle a lot of things all at once. And we sort of knew it was going to be like this. It was going to be try and take a sort of system approach. And it does that by breaking down it into three separate areas. One is about the specific things around employment and skills and training, and trying to think about how to bring data and insight and sort of connection and connectivity into that kind of employer skills matrix. Second bit is about strengthening FE, raising standards, supporting high quality teaching, supporting HE and FE collaboration, new technical excellence college, new kinds of 16 to 19 qualifications, lots of different things going on in that space. And then the third chapter is about higher education and research, and it's got absolutely masses in it. So this is, I think, you know, to anyone who sort of said that this white paper was going to be a bit of a damp squib, not much in it, I think it's been proved wrong. The question I think that everybody will be thinking about in the weeks and months to come is whether all of those recommendations and plans and proposals add up to the sort of material change that is going to deliver on that ambitious agenda to get 2/3 of young people into some kind of higher level learning. And that I think is very much up for debate.
So it's been a long time coming. It's been delayed. It feels like we've been waiting for it almost since Labour took power. But, you know, it sort of was promised for the summer and has arrived now. It's clearly something they've been developing for a long time. Lots of the bits of pieces in it we've heard about already. You know, there's a bit of a feeling when you're sort of reading through it, you see, especially if you're a keen wonky reader or a wonky staffer, there's lots of stuff that we already knew about. Even some of the stuff, you know, they say we will do this, and it's things they've already done. You know, but I think if you sort of ignore that side of things and remember it's something that, you know, needed an awful lot of ministerial sign off and waiting for the industrial strategy and other bits and pieces and budgets and spending reviews, you know, there is quite a sort of coherent vision for how Labour does want to reshape the higher education sector and the skills landscape. You know, whether the levers are there, I think, is another question. But yeah, no, there's an awful lot in it. And, you know, whether it's worth the wait is the next question.
DK, was it worth the wait?
Difficult to say at this point. A lot of it depends on the way it lands. At the moment, most of the discussion is about the big story, which we'll get to shortly, which is the inflationary rise in tuition fees. But the argument is trying to sell, which I thought was interesting, was around the idea of collaboration and specialization. There's a lot of words, if not much actual policy, about the idea that the thing that is going to drive this is research specialization. It's going to make higher education providers think more closely about what they do well, what they need to specialize in, where they can collaborate. On that basis, it is incredibly ambitious. It's not something that I've really seen tried before, but for a sector that is looking primarily for a fix for the financial woes that it is currently facing, locking in the current unit of resource in real terms for all of the years going forward is probably not going to make a lot of people very happy.
Okay, so let's spell this out, Michael. Explain exactly what's going on with fees and funding and the money side of things and what's been announced in the white paper today.
Yeah, so I mean, this has probably been, you know, where the sector's eyes have been most carefully trained. It's something we've been trying to read the runes on for a long time. You know, the government has, I think, sort of said, especially via the papers, one fairly negative thing after another. Like if you cast your mind back to sort of June when they were saying, you know, what vice chancellors are going to be named and shamed for poor outcomes and, you know, all the sort of negativity that comes the sector's way. I think for a while we've been saying, okay, this is about them slow rolling the introduction of a yearly uplift in tuition fees. And that's exactly what we've got. So they're going to, for the next two academic years, they're going to be raised by inflation forecasts, apart from foundation years, classroom-based foundation years. So we might want to talk about that. And then after that, you know, via legislation, which is going to be a sort of longer process. And obviously they felt it wasn't going to be in place in either for this year or next year, but they're going to legislate to re-establish an index link between inflation forecasts and tuition fees. So the sort of default will be that each year,
tuition fees go up by what they think inflation will be.
And Jim, there's something similar for that in maintenance as well, isn't there? And can you explain what's different between what's being announced today and what they previously said?
Well, the policy for a decade has been to increase the maximum maintenance loan for home students and the PGT loan and so on by projected inflation. Nothing has changed today. That's exactly the status quo. And the compound problem, really, that universities also now face is that, you know, if you think about how much the maintenance loan maximum has gone up by this year, 3.1%, that was the projection. Inflation right now is 4.1%. And DfE itself projects that the average mean maintenance loan will only go up by 2.5% this year. And that's because they haven't done anything to the means test threshold, this over £25,000 of household income. You have to start putting parental contribution in. So even if you just take the headline, Bridget Phillipson's claim a few weeks ago at party conference that she'll deal with this thing where students having to work all hours God sends and so on, actually, all she's announced is the status quo. But of course, buried in the mechanism is something worse than status quo. So it's a pretty raw deal for students.
I guess one of the criticisms of the announcement, Debbie, we're listening to the statement of Parliament from Bridget Phillipson this evening, she was criticised from the opposition of all people who've been ratcheting up graduate repayments and thresholds for all their time in government in recent years. But she was criticised on the basis that graduates are going to be paying more back over their lifetime as a result of a fees and maintenance grant increase. It's technically true, but does it open, do you think, the door to a conversation about the terms of the graduate repayments and where those different lines are drawn? Or do you think we may end up in an even worse situation with a more aggressive graduate repayment system because the government are going to have to front more loans up front, basically?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty easy gotcha for government, isn't it? You know, and this is, you know, Bridget Phillipson was, you know, writing in the papers saying we're going to have reduced graduate repayments. The fact that they're not really indicating at this point that this is something that they're planning to do is exactly the sort of thing that the opposition is going to pounce on. But I do think that a calculation has been made in all of this, which is that the challenges, as much as you might wish to see, you know, fairer, more generous terms for graduate repayment, some of the real challenges that exist within the skills system relate to young people who've been massively disadvantaged all the way through, to the inequalities between FE and HE funding, to the fact that FE teachers are not as well paid, you know, for example, the funding for colleges is not kept pace. The fact that if you don't get your level 2 GCSE qualification in English and maths, is genuinely you can be shut out of you know, future education opportunities indefinitely. This is the government decided those are the things it wants to try and solve. And you know, it is, you know, in one kind of through one lens, I suppose that there's an unfairness in that. But this is really, really tricky economic times, and that's the sort of calculation, the sort of difficult choices that you have to make when you're in government.
Well, and one of the things that jumped out at me at the white paper at the first reading was ambition, or at least, you know, the acceptance that they're going to need to allow fees to rise automatically with inflation every year, rather than have a positive vote by both houses of parliament every single time they want to make any changes to tuition fee levels, which has been this kind of totemic problem we've had since the whole fee settlement was put in place. Obviously heavily criticised by the sector and others who wanted to depoliticise the question of tuition fees and didn't want a political storm every time it had to go up by inflation. And it caused a huge problem for the last government and the last kind of variations of that government, because ministers there kind of wanted to put up tuition fees, you often thought, and you know, pretty much said as much themselves, but felt they couldn't because of the parliamentary arithmetic and the worry about creating a big storm. So anyway, there's an ambition in the white paper to allow this to go up over time automatically. But, you know, there is a fair amount of quid pro quo, and the international student levy, the biggest one, but a bunch of other stuff. Just, Jim Coe, how do you see this as an overall package? We know they're giving, they're, it's, well, look, it's, I struggle to say they're giving more to the sector. sector, they made a positive decision not to allow money to flow out too quickly.
Yeah.
Although it will be flowing out at some, you know, at a rate. But there, you know, there are some mechanisms to allow money to flow out more slowly, if you like. And, you know, positive decisions not to cut too deeply.
Yeah.
But where do you see that balance? You know, it's obviously going to be a lean few years ahead. As a financial settlement, if it stacks up, how do you think the sector is going to work with this?
Yeah, I think the first way to put it, Mark, is they've made a deliberate decision not to make things worse on purpose, is probably the fairest way to put it. I mean, the big thing the government seems to have largely realized is that the financial incentives the sector has encourages homogeneity in all kinds of ways. It encourages people to teach similar things to similar students, research similar things, etc. So whilst there is a funding increase, what comes with that is incentives to specialize more effectively. We'll talk about the research elements later, but there are things in there like reprofiling strategic priorities grant to look more like the industrial strategy, to change some of the research impact measurements that the funding follows to look at economic growth, to encourage universities to teach more on a regional basis to fill skills gaps, and lots of promises to look at the regulation that allows that. So I think the quid pro quo being offered here is we will not let things get gradually worse. We will stop the sector from collapsing. But in return, you have to make the economy bigger, and we are not going to fund people to teach and research the same things in the same places for the same purposes.
DK, so fees are going up, but they're not going up for everyone, are they?
That's right, Mark. There's always been a nominal link between the fee cap, all of the fee caps as they currently exist, and the Teaching Excellence Framework, the TEF. So the proposal here appears to be, although we don't get the exact terms in the white paper, which would be far too useful, quite frankly. The plan appears to be that if you do well in the TEF, I would say getting a gold or a silver looks like you will be allowed to raise your fees up to the new fee cap. If you don't do quite so well, as a way of introducing these pockets of low quality provision that we keep hearing about, as a way of addressing those, you will not be able to increase. And of course, as Michael has pointed out earlier on, if you're offering a classroom based foundation year, you don't get to increase your fees at all, possibly ever.
I guess the other thing that becomes quite interesting about this is this problem where I can't think of any other form of government policy which is has a headline of index linking something. You know, normally this is about benefits, you know, but there are other things that are index linked that uses a projection of inflation. And, you know, the point about the student finance end of this is that the OBR has been consistently wrong, and inflation has consistently turned out significantly higher. That now becomes a problem, not just for students, but for the sector too. You know, right now we have inflation at a full 1 percentage point higher than the OBR projected it would be. And so, you know, the headline may well be that on the core unit of resource, you know, everything is going to be index linked. But if we continue to use the OBR's projection, I'd be quite interested to know what the OBR thinks about this. If we continue to use the OBR's projection, that there may well be, if it keeps undershooting, be some quite significant problems, even with trying to stand still on that core unit of resource.
And Debbie, I mean, a lot of these measures connect to the kind of the opportunity mission, as has been talking about it previously. And there are some tangible things and a whole section on access and participation and how that relates to all of this, isn't there?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, and although I think what's interesting to me is that it's there, because I think the real kind of the real game in access participation these days is probably a bit less about very selective institutions doing things to support, you know, so there's stuff in there about, you know, support, you know, to support kind of the less advantaged students coming in. So there's stuff in there about that operates in that space. There's things about the, you know, the information, there's going to be a task force about bringing together, looking at the information that students have access to and how that can kind of support good choices. But for me, I think the kind of the landscape has shifted around access, and it's, you know, and it's not a million miles from what John Blake at OFS is kind of doing anyway, which is trying to think about that regional picture, about the different pipelines, about the connections between FE and HE provision, about supporting people to do things like level 4 and level 5, as well as you know, getting into degrees and stuff like that. So I think that kind of speaks to changing the accountabilities around what's measured on access, as well as kind of thinking quite carefully about that kind of, I guess, increasingly small part of the sector, which is about kind of the kind of traditional ways of thinking about access. And I think one of the really, really interesting kind of ideas, although I'm not sure it will go down brilliantly, is that as a condition of being able to get funding to deliver level six provision, you have to offer exit points. So if a student comes in and wants to kind of exit with a level four qualification, level five, you know, short of the full degree, that you have to kind of make that possible for them to do. And that not only kind of encourages portability, you know, they could kind of take that level four or five in principle, that qualification elsewhere, and kind of top it up later in life, or they could just sort of pause, or, you know, there is a kind of inclusion dimension to that proposal. But it also means that students are not spending more on their education than they need to get the job they want. And that, to me, speaks to a kind of major agenda around information, advice and guidance and the kind of the collaborative context that might facilitate those sorts of movements, which I think, you know, I'm not going to lie, at the minute is quite undercooked, but there's lots of indications towards thinking about how those things can be made real.
Yeah, I think that point about the cold spots task force or task and finish group, I think it calls it, I think is an interesting one, because I think it's quite symptomatic of, you know, DfE's thinking. As you said before, Debbie, that, you know, the bits of the education system they're really interested in sort of putting the limited resource they have into are the bits where HE is not so present at the moment, either, you know, sort of socioeconomically or geographically, or, you know, in all kinds of different ways. We don't know so much about this task force yet. I think it said in the press release it's going to be chaired by the University of Derby Vice Chancellor Catherine Mitchell. But yeah, I think it's interesting that they've picked up on this idea of sort of, you know, HE interventions involving sort of tackling cold spots, because it's also something that Universities UK has been talking about. You know, they've said it's something they want to do work on with the Association of Colleges. I think across the sector, there's a sort of recognition increasingly that it's this kind of way that universities and higher education sector can sort of show their value to the population, position themselves ahead of the next election. It's not so much doing the business as usual things and, you know, continuing to grow or even just sustaining the existing provision they've got.
I mean, there's also something for me there about cracking down on low quality provision, because actually one of the things that we sort of know or have seen in the last sort of 5 years or so is that it's the students with less social capital, with, you know, who perhaps are already have jobs, you know, who are coming from a kind of less well-informed position, who are much more likely to find themselves in the sort of in the lower quality provision and have sort of outcomes accordingly. And that's where I think finding bits of the system where this is not about kind of stimulating demand for, you know, or raising aspirations. This is about helping people understand what the implications of the choices they're making, and also putting proper protections in place for when things are not being delivered. And so I think, you know, for me, I think this idea that there's an access agenda that is sort of distinctive from everything else, you know, that, you know, we could probably sort of, to some extent, I think there might be a little bit of a space for.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team, or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
For some kind of specific measures, but I think that's now the whole system. Once you make the whole system about skills, then that's where you land.
Now, James Coe, there's quite a lot in there for research, isn't there? Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, there's loads. Look at me up the bill on the Wonky Podcast. So, it's interesting, right, Mark? If you read it line by line, you think, oh, this is littered with stuff I've seen before, funding announcements that have already been announced, regional funds, all the usual stuff. But if you squint and you read the implications, something really interesting happens. And there is this core idea that the way that research funding is structured means that everybody researches similar things to try and win the games, like REF and everything like that. The government is saying that makes no sense. And what they're saying is, we are going to change research funding in order to encourage specialization. Great, sensible, you know, I'd see where that goes. But even stronger, what they are arguing is, if you encourage specialization in research, in their own words, given the close link between research and teaching, we expect these changes to support specialisation of high-quality teaching provision as well. The big idea seems to be, if you move the needle on research funding, you move the research on teaching, and that's how you get the specialisation question. I don't think it'll work, and I don't think it'll work for two reasons. If you don't change the underpinning unit of support for teaching, then you just keep doing comprehensive stuff. And on the research front, people research the stuff that they have. The academics do research, not institutions, in that way. But it's a big, brave idea, right? And it's exactly the type of thing you want to see float in a white paper.
Yeah, I mean, here we are, you know, on the Wonky podcast, you know, nitpicking about the policy detail, about the government's plans for such and such, you know, I mean, how dare we? But I mean, the point is, some of this is about the mood music, about what they're trying to achieve, right, in the overall ambition. And it is interesting, isn't it, that they, between the research elements of the white paper and the kind of more teaching elements, if you're to divide it in that way, as at least when it comes to higher education, then it does point to a vision of what they want everyone to get to, as you mentioned, the specialization for one. But I guess what I'm really interested in is what the balance here is in the incentives for universities and others who operate in the research landscape to take this as an agenda, partly for growth, partly for the industrial strategy, partly for blue skies research and the other reasons we do all the research and the science and everything else. I'm interested in kind of that balance between what, you know, the kind of the hairs they're running, you know, with this, and how much of it is a challenge to institutions and people in that space, in the kind of research space. Because, you know, this is a decent size white paper for the post-16 education skills landscape with, you know, a bunch of paragraphs on research, but really interesting and quite meaningful and instructive, aren't they? So yeah. I guess just Jim, I just want you, you know, I want you to give us that sense of how much here is, do you think, is being pushed onto the sector, and how much do we really expect there to be government action and change when it comes to the kind of the funding and the regulatory and the systematic kind of infrastructure behind the whole research ecosystem? Because they're not talking about tearing up the ref or anything like that, are they?
No, some big questions in there, Mark. And, you know, I think the way to look at this is the reform of higher education is the goal and research is the means in which to do it. And I think a really legitimate criticism of the last government was to say that all the research stuff that came out felt like it was picked at random and nothing ever fit together. You had moonshots, you had Britain's a superpower, you had all of this stuff. Labour's core proposition is that research is a tool to grow the economy. You have to grow the economy so things get better and people get better lives than Labour in the next election. So what they are saying to the sector is, demonstrate that the research you do will grow the economy and we'll back you. We'll still back blue sky research, but we are going to fiddle with some of the incentives. And exactly as you point out, Mark, they are not saying we have to get rid of everything, we have to start again. What they're saying is things like the REF should support people who do economic growth. If you want to specialise in that, you should get rewarded. They're going to look at reforming HIFE funding. That should reward growth. And interestingly, they also talk about backing research which has the highest economic potential. Now, that isn't saying the places that already have the highest economic growth, which suggests an element of regional redistribution. I think the massive challenge for universities, and we're writing an upcoming paper on this, is the promise is grow the economy, you get rewarded. But at the moment, their incentives work against it. If they realign incentives for universities to grow the economy, well, it's sort of time to put our money where our mouth is on that one. You know, we say we do it and government's going to reward it. I suppose, I think the final challenge is, like, the real test in this is actually what will the mechanisms look like. Everybody's seen collaboration is a good idea. The idea that you could share grant funding, which is in there, that feels a bit random to me because, of course, that already happens a bit, is a good idea. But what will this actually look like? Will it be enough funding? Will it be regionally focused? And will it actually move the dial on things like aligning the units of resource to it?
The thing that I think is really interesting about this is I think it's particularly interesting to say, look, at the end of the day, we can only spread the research funding as wide as it'll go to make sure that everyone, you know, that the people who are doing the good research are able to continue to do the good research that has impact. And that has real consequences for institutions that a lot of people will be really unhappy with, I think it's fair to say, although it's been heavily signalled, including by Patrick Vallance at the UK conference. But I think the tie-in to the specialisation, this idea that, you know, we need more specialist institutions that are playing to their strengths, and we are specifically and literally going to use research funding to cause that to happen. I think that feels really new to me. Yeah. It's always been, you know, there's always been this sort of sense that, you know, you want a broad base of teaching, and if you can kind of sort of sustain research on top of that, if you're not a sort of research intensive institution, then kind of more power to your elbows. They're now saying, you know, and actually we have seen some excellence kind of emerge from that, you know, in REF terms, and that's always been seen as a real strength of the sector. This is a government that's saying, no, you're all trying to do far too much. You're all trying to recruit too many students across too broad a base of delivery. You need to figure out what you are absolutely cracking at, and then you need to work with the other institutions around you to figure out how you can kind of create create that ecosystem at regional level. And, you know, and using, and basically the only funding lever available is research funding. So that's what, how we're going to do it. And that is, you know, that, I mean, I'm sort of, it's not very clear how, because, you know, the ref cycles only happen, you know, once every sort of 7 years or 8 years or whatever it is. I think, so there's going to have to be other levers as well. And that's where I think the real kind of, that's the thing that's going to really transform the sector for the next decade or more.
And I know Michael and Jim will have views on this, but I suppose what is interesting is the exact wording saying we want fewer broad specialist providers. And they talk about providers as being teaching only, applied research with teaching and research. That just isn't really how we think about the sector now. It is such a massive shift to say that, yes, you can prioritize it. And the last thing I suppose worth saying on that, the Nurse Review left the question open of, do you want to keep funding lots of research in this really broad way that leaves everyone unhappy? Or do you want to do fewer things better funded? And the government have landed on the latter to say you can do less stuff and have a bit more cash for it.
Yeah. And that clearly has implications back to the other ambitions for collaboration in the sector. If we're going to stratify at least the two or three major chunks of higher education universities, if we're going to stratify the sector into two or three major chunks of higher education providers that are doing, you know, on some spectrum of that kind of doing research, then that is going to alter the market, and it's going to alter the signals about where people should go and the sorts of courses they should do and where and when in their lives and everything else. Jim Dickinson, I know you wanted to come in briefly here.
I mean, the thing that really strikes me about this is that there are two types of gold spot, right? One is, oh, look, there's a bit of the country where there's no HE at all. But there's a much more important kind of cold spot that emerges from this, which is, I used to be able to do X subject within my region. Now I can't because of specialisation. And that means I'm more likely to have to leave home to go to university with very high rents and not a very good maintenance package and so on. You know, you can't really do both, which is to have maximum access for people to follow what will remain relatively specialised degrees in specialised institutions, and then simultaneously be suddenly chopping off lots of subject areas from what are currently broad-based, what you might call comprehensive universities. It doesn't add up. So from a kind of student choice point of view, the weird thing for me is, if I was in Europe, maybe there are some countries where I could build my, you know, bachelor's degree from two or three institutions with credit acquisition from various of them. I don't think anything in the white paper particularly encourages that. And so if that's not on offer, and the ability to do interdisciplinary stuff is starting to narrow because institutions specialise, this feels like actually it ends up going in the wrong direction in comparison to what our competitors are doing.
Yeah, I agree with what everyone said that about, you know, it's unclear whether these sort of specific levers the government is looking to pull are really up to the task of this sort of big rearrangement of how it wants the whole size and shape of the sector to be. But just the other thing that I sort of strikes me, you know, is there actually a plan in place to sort of evaluate this happening? If you go right down to the end of the white paper about, you know, what are the metrics they're judging success on, is all about individual learners and, you know, proportions of 25-year-olds accessing this. There's nothing in there about, you know, we're going to sort of keep an eye and judge our progress and judge ourselves on, you know, what different types of institutions look like. And once that's not there, I kind of wonder whether it just ends up being, you know, a sort of someone's nice aspiration for what things look like, but it doesn't end up being something that there's sort of dedicated work towards, and also, you know, thinking through in real depth all the problems that it could you know, give rise to.
Now, Jim, tell us where students were in all of this.
Curiously, if you think about the last few white papers, students weren't really in there at all. So, you know, we've talked about this index linking of maintenance loans. I mean, one of the things that is kind of interesting about that, by the way, is that, you know, lots of this white paper is pretty much the Augar review only put to work. And of course, one of the things about the Augar review is that it promised to link the maintenance package to the minimum wage. Now, Low Pay Commission is predicting that the minimum wage will go up by 4.1% next year. If that happens, and the OBR's projection on inflation is right, we'll be £3,400 on the maximum loan out from where Augar thought students would be. So that gives you a sense of just quite how far we've drifted on the kind of student maintenance proposals from the ambitions that were, you know, there in the Augar review. Lots of the Augar review been implemented, certainly that bit hasn't. There's then, if you compare again to the Augar review, a couple of bits that have kind of made it through. So there's a line in there that says that universities will need to work with other universities in their area and the local authority to make sure that there is a, I think it says, a statement of expectations about making sure there's enough student accommodation. Now, reality is there's already one of those. Universities UK published it 3 or 4 years ago. Almost no university follows it. It's hard to believe that universities will. And certainly if you look at the fundamental reshaping of student demand that we've seen, those UCAS figures, there's plenty of evidence actually that universities that have expanded very, very rapidly certainly haven't been following that Universities UK guidance. There's then a couple of other bits that have been chucked in. So we have been waiting for Sharia compliant finance to appear at some point. That has actually been worked out by the civil servants many years ago, has been waiting to be published. And you can kind of feel the embarrassment where the word Islam and the word Muslim doesn't appear at all, but nevertheless, alternative student finance is referenced. We know what that means. God alone knows what someone reading the white paper will make of it, unless they understand what alternative student finance actually is. And then apart from that, that's pretty much it. Students, in terms of their choices, some of the complexities around some of the edges of student finance, certainly nothing in there on postgraduate loans. There's one line in there that says that care leavers will automatically get the maximum maintenance loan, which presumably will mean the what must amount to what, 4 or 5 probably maximum in the entire country, care leavers who aren't currently getting the maximum maintenance loan will now get the maximum maintenance loan. The point remains that for a care leaver, the maximum maintenance loan ain't enough.
So this whole accommodation supply and demand issue has been rumbling on for a number of years. Does anyone here think there's a kind of statement of expectations as been announced in a white paper? Is that going to move the dial at all?
It's a start, isn't it? I mean, it is good that they're talking about. We've had the beginnings and the slow progression of the review in Scotland. And I think a lot of people have been looking for some kind of strategic thinking about where students are going to live while they're studying in England. It's not quite that. The idea of a statement of expectations just really means that providers are going to be talking more to local priorities. But in the best examples, such as in Nottingham, this is something that is happening already. Is there really any regulatory heft to it? It doesn't feel like it at the moment, but perhaps it's a step on the way to getting there.
I don't know. I mean, when you read the bit, DK, about the analysis which says people on low incomes find it harder to afford expensive accommodation, I think you just sort of lose the will to live slightly on the quality of analysis that is being presented. It doesn't feel very serious. Yeah, I mean, like, definitely true, but I'm not sure it's going to solve the problem.
And, you know, crucially, the really interesting thing that is happening again this year, and we saw this a couple of years ago, is that a number of cities have tipped into oversupply of purpose-built student accommodation. And it is entirely unclear what happens to those cities when that happens, because you can't just turn purpose-built student accommodation into accommodation for other people, because by definition, it's been designed to have much, much smaller rooms. It remains the case, if you look across this, that in a way it's sort of breathtaking that the government is introducing a Renters Rights Act and isn't even committing in this bit of the white paper to monitoring the impacts on students, when the potential impacts of students have been debated endlessly by both the Commons and the Lords. You know, that whole question of geography, where, to the extent to which it rubs up against planning and student choice, is kind of just avoided here, kind of grimly inevitably. But I suspect that in the medium term, that's going to come to bite the government with, as I say, parts of the country with a massive undersupply, which then impacts local people, and parts of the country with massive oversupply, which creates huge resentment then towards higher education. Because what we know from the polling is that people see the shiny buildings, don't realise they're privately owned, and wonder why their town and city is still empty, but, you know, all the only money that's being spent in my area is on these bloody students.
There's something there on widening access to postgraduate study, which, if you know, my kind of 2010 self would have been thrilled to have read in a government white paper, because that was the thing I used to work on in NUS.
But then doesn't mention PG loans. I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, I think there's something that's quite sort of characteristic about this white paper, which is it is a bit of a smorgasbord of every single thing that has kind of crossed Bridget Phillipson's desk in the last year and a half, right? I mean, that's kind of, you know, and I think what in some ways there's something in that which says, you know, okay, we hear you. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of stuff here. Let's get a task force. Let's get a group. Let's get a thing underway. You know, that to me. You know, I completely see the criticism as, you know, there's not a total coherence here and we're operating against a very different economic backdrop. But that does feel a little bit like the policy of 15 years ago when it was sort of saying, well, let's get some people around the table and we'll get some ideas together. There's quite a lot of that sort of, you know, bitty bits and bobs which pop up throughout, you know, things around like sort of funding for anti-Semitism, you know, tackling anti-Semitism, and, you know, lots of, you know, sort of, you know, good policy work that, you know, it might not be deep analysis, but it's kind of causing stuff to begin to happen. Yeah. And there's, you know, and I think that's as legitimate a theory of change as any when you've got like quite a lot else to be going on with in government.
And even if the bits are bitty, I'd still rather they existed than they didn't in lots of places. So, you know, extending OFS's equality opportunities register to postgrads is a good idea. Reforming the UK arrived from BGRs already exists, but fine, reminders that it's still going on.
I mean, I already know how those conversations go, but you know, it's never a bad idea to keep revisiting some of these things and saying, okay, how do we, what does that mean for the current environment that we're in? How do we align that to the broader policy stuff? And, you know, you need ideas from coming from within the sector actually to make that real. Otherwise, it's just, you know, civil servants saying, well, we think it might be this, but who can say?
Yeah. But yeah, extend access to stuff. I'm all in favour of that and it being just like this.
Yeah. But I mean, look, on postgraduate access, the fundamental for me is that certainly at PGT level, there doesn't appear to be any evidence that I've heard from around the sector that to the extent to which there's a postgraduate tour access problem for home students, that is about, you know, entry standards being too high. Actually, what everyone is saying is the loan doesn't cover the fee. And so, you know, if at the absolute core here, the problem is not institutions' access policies, the problem is that the student finance system that is supposed to, you know, underpin all of this is broken, then it doesn't matter how many access and participation plans have got a chapter on we'll let more PGTs to do certain subjects. If they can't afford it, they can't afford it.
Hi, it's Mark here from the team, interrupting your podcast to remind you that we are now in the final countdown to the Festival of Higher Education, which is just a few weeks away. In case you've been living under a rock, the festival is the biggest, most exciting and relentlessly interesting event in HE. Here for ministers, policymakers, wonks of every stripe as they come together for today's sector leadership and tomorrow's future stars. We've got data, we've got debate, we've got analysis, we've got interviews, all focused on the biggest and most thorny problems facing UK higher education today. And of course, we've got fun and hijinks too. Four stages, two amazing days, plus one massive party. There's nothing quite like it. We think it's going to be the biggest and best festival we've ever staged. So big, in fact, I'm going to need a lie down after all this excitement. Yes, the rumours are true, the festival will be taking a break next year, so it's your last chance to be part of something like this for a while. We hope to see you there. That's 11th and 12th of November at the University of London. Discounts are available for Wonky subscribers, of course, and you can find out all the details at thefestivalofhe.com. Finally, there's quite a lot about quality and regulation in this white paper with some far-reaching implications. DK, can you walk us through the key measures and then we're going to talk about their implications?
There's a lot going on here. So I love the little quote, among students who found their university experience worse than they'd expected, teaching quality was amongst the most commonly cited reasons. Improving transparency about course quality is absolutely essential. So there's loads of ways of doing this. I mean, traditionally speaking, white papers have always had a section on improving applicant information. In this particular instance, I mean, DfE have spotted what UCAS are doing on adding the stuff about the historic entry grades to their course pages. They want to add in the stuff from Discover Uni. Isn't that exciting? No, but it's a thing and it will probably happen. The big news, I think, really is on the franchising stuff, that consultation that DfE had about the larger franchise providers registering with OFS. in order to access funding. We've not seen, I don't think, the consultation response yet, but it does look like that's going ahead. And you'll be thrilled to learn the Office for Students is going to be getting some more powers, because that's what's been missing from our regulatory system, I think, is the OFS having more power to do stuff. They're getting powers to intervene decisively on the franchising issue. This includes stronger powers of entry, the ability to make interim sanctions, reinforced investigative powers, even a sharpened up right of entry so they can absolutely rock up to your campus and tell you what you're doing wrong at this point, and that will be absolutely fine, apparently. The OFS is going to get a bit more capacity as well, so not just powers, also money. The outcome being it will be able to respond more rapidly when there's risks identified. Supposedly, it needs legislation to impose recruitment caps where growth is a risk to quality, despite the fact it's already done this four times, the last time being at Burton and South Derbyshire College, of course. Let's talk also about external examiners. Somebody somewhere is not happy about external examiners and the external examining system. They've been whispering to DfE. That's all now apparently up for debate, linked to the OFS looking at their degree awarding powers and how they're awarded. DfE are going to be building an evidence base on the effectiveness or otherwise of the approach of using external examiners to make sure everything's broadly comparable. Lastly, let's mention the Progress 8 style measure. If you're not familiar with schools policy, Progress 8 is a look at what the FE reckon are the key subjects and how well students do in them. There's going to be something like that in higher education. I've no idea. It looks a little bit like it might be learning gain again, but I mean, let's see what comes out of the pot on this. So that's the government and OFS working together to smarten that one up. Exciting stuff.
All right, there's a lot to unpack here. Debbie, the one of the things that's going to be catching the sector's eye this week is this kind of student number control type system linked to fees, linked to quality. Can you try and just contextualize and explain for us what they're trying to achieve here and what this actually is probably going to mean?
Yeah, so I mean, this is not a million miles from what governments have been trying to do for some time now, which is to try and identify low quality and say, if you've got low quality, you can't expand at the rate that you might wish to, and you can't charge fees at the level that you might wish to, and, you know, create this sort of sense of differentiation. I think that part of this is about the sort of reality that low quality is a bit of a kind of, it's a bit of a moving target, you know. You can have your B3 thresholds about student outcomes, but that is sort of at best an indicator of what might be going on. You can look at, you know, you can look at the sort of gargantuan profits in some franchise provision and think, well, that doesn't seem right, and all the rest of it. But at the end of the day, unless you've kind of got boots on the ground, it's very hard to say kind of categorically. And there's quite a lot of that sort of provision about. So sort of coming down unilaterally and universally on all of it becomes quite challenging. So I think, I mean, what this is, I suspect, is something of a shot across the bows, you know, sort of saying, look, you know, we're taking this seriously. I think what it also constitutes is a real doubling down, actually, on OFS and a sort of, I guess, a sort of commitment to, you know, this the regulatory regime that we have in place right now. So the assumption that, you know, OFS needs more powers to crack down on low quality, that this is something that OFS is a regulator, is best placed to deliver and should sort of continue to do so. And not only that, we'll be taking on more regulation for level four and above provision in FE colleges, which previously would have been funded by adult learning loans and regulated from a completely different place. So this is about saying, let's put all of this entire post higher education bit in, give it to also OFS. OFS will take a view about what quality looks like across the piece, and then we'll be given powers to actually crack down on where it doesn't see it. Whether the sector believes that's the way forward, I think, is an entirely separate question. This government has said, no, this is where we're going with this.
Yeah, yeah. And Jem, obviously, widely trailed, much expected section on franchise and subcontracted provision. We've obviously been writing about this for a number of years on Wonky and most recently on the Post-18 project. How do you think the proposals stack up against what we've outlined as kind of some of the biggest risks and problems with this part of the sector?
Well, look, one thing to say that actually, if you remember, Bridget Phillipson promised when the Sunday Times ran its splash earlier in the year, is I think the line was along the lines of, domestic agents have no role to play in this sector, or, you know, words to that effect. That has come out in the white paper as, and I've read this sentence four or five times, it doesn't make any sense to me still, but if anyone else can make sense of this, then go for it. The sentence is, we will explore tightening eligibility for access to the student finance system to sever the income stream for unscrupulous agents by removing illegitimate student recruitment. That seems to suggest that if you tackle the problematic providers, then you no longer have problematic domestic agents. And I can assure the Department for Education that there will still be plenty of highly problematic domestic agents selling higher education in particular ways, making money out of doing so by obscuring certain features of, you know, the higher education system, selling certain features of the higher education system that aren't associated with, you know, the reality. And that is a very different thing to what was promised. And it brings you back to a different question, which is nothing in here has any commentary on the amount of profit being made by generalist private providers. There are no measures that will tackle that, nothing that can deal with some of those figures that we had on the site on Monday. And I continue to think that that is a major problem.
Now, I'm going to ask everyone for one other interesting thing that they've noticed from the white paper and what it might mean. Obviously, we'll be diving into all of the detail on wonky.com and all of our various channels over the coming days and weeks. But I'd like to kind of pick out a few more things. Jim Coe, what was one other thing that you found interesting in the white paper?
The government is all of a sudden very concerned about people being referable, Mark, which, you know, is exactly why they reformed this to introduce people, culture and environment. But exactly the same time, the government also wants to ensure that REF aligns with government priorities. So I think we're going to get a change to REF, but in which direction, I simply cannot tell you.
Mm. DK, your one other interesting thing, please.
Okay, so if you talk to anybody who works in a university that used to be a polytechnic, you will have heard about the teachers' pension scheme and how the government have massively uprated how much employers have to pay into that. And it's really, really hurting the ability of these providers to employ staff. Apparently, the government are going to seek to better understand concerns. That's a direct quote. The concerns are, if there's any civil servants listening, that it's getting really, really expensive and universities can't afford it.
Hmm. Debbie, your one other interesting thing.
For me, what jumped out was the stuff on governance, because I think, you know, running through this kind of proposals around HE reform is this sense about, look, you know, we're dealing with autonomous institutions. They need to, you know, have strategies that are appropriate to their context. And it's not, you know, it's not the role of government to direct that. But also we would really like everyone to be a bit more collaborative and a bit more efficient and a bit more aligned to our economic agenda. Thank you very much. What's in there is this real sense about, you know, as government, we are taking an interest in higher education governance. We're endorsing the CUC's looking again at the code of governance. You know, we are setting out a kind of expectation that governance will be, you know, that the boards of governors will be able to kind of do the strategic work that is needed to deliver transformation where that is needed, and you know, not to kind of get institutions into financial trouble. We support OFS to look at strengthening the condition of registration around governance. That seems to me to be a really interesting space where I think autonomy comes up against government objectives, and one that's really worth keeping an eye on.
Mm, and more of that from the Poster Team Project in the coming weeks. Jim Dickinson, your one other interesting thing, please.
Yeah, so mine is, there's a line in there that says, the government wants providers to expect that all students will learn about artificial intelligence as part of their higher education experience. And then it also says, while stressing that AI should support learning rather than substitute assessed work, and then links that to OFS's oversight of assessment integrity. So the first thing I would say is OFS has famously thus far completely avoided the question of AI in assessment in its regulatory framework. So maybe OFS first needs to learn about all of this. But the question that comes up is, does it mean use AI or learn about AI? And if so, is this just another one of those, which we seem to get every fortnight, I've written about this on the site, another one of those, this needs to go in the higher education curriculum, because this feels like an encroachment on institutional autonomy and student choice to me.
Both those things you are noted championing for, of course. Michael, your one other thing, please.
Yeah, well, if I can just take a bit of a liberty as we're wrapping up, I mean, I think the other thing that really stands out to me is all of the big ambitious things they're looking at in the rest of the skills system, and also the things that aren't really there. You know, so for example, the growth and skills levy, the sort of reformed apprenticeship levy, there's very little about it. You know, it is still coming. They're committed to it. They're calling these new short courses they're launching, they're going to be henceforth known as apprenticeship units. But you can see they're sort of tentative about how much money will be available. There's nothing about sort of wider levy reform, or, you know, there's a bit of sort of words about employers contributing more, but there's, you know, there's nothing very sort of fundamental there. The word degree apprenticeship doesn't even appear in the white paper. I mean, can you imagine such a thing under sort of Robert Halfen? V levels, we haven't mentioned at all, but an enormous change to sort of post-3 qualifications. There's a huge new consultation that's just opened tonight, and, you know, that where the government sets out quite a lot of their thinking there. So, you know, everyone in the sector will be taking an interest in that. You know, and just finally also, I mean, one of the narratives we got in the run-up was about incentivizing HEFE collaboration, you know, getting higher education providers, further education colleges, really working together seamlessly, coherent skill system. There's not actually that much about that. I mean, there's warm words, but there aren't these sort of, you know, proper changes to the landscape, apart from a little bit around sort of local skills improvement plans. You know, so I do wonder, and, you know, that's sort of symptomatic of the whole white paper, right? Is, you know, there's a vision, but are there the levers? And are there the sort of, you know, are the levers that are going to pull the right ones?
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com, where our coverage will be building in the coming days. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. If talking HE is your thing, do grab a ticket for the Festival of Higher Education, where Skills Minister Jackie Smith will be on stage to discuss the white paper. Follow the links on wonky.com. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Debbie, DK, Jim, Jimbo, Michael, Salmon for making it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.